Now we have a conversation with Alexis Connison, who's a clinical psychologist in practice in New York City and a researcher at the New York Obesity Nutrition Research Center at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital. Alexis Connison writes and appears at many media outlets. You can find her blog called Eating Mindfully at Psychology Today. It's hosted by Psychology Today. So we'll talk about eating mindfully, also talk about something that Dr. Connison talks about, which is the anti-diet plan. And we began our conversation talking about sugar. And I asked Dr. Connison whether sugar is addictive.
When we look at some of the research around sugar and sugar addiction, it does show similarities to other substances of abuse in the reward centers of our brain. Now, does that mean that sugar is addictive? There's a lot of things that show similar patterns in the reward systems in our brain, including pretty much anything that's pleasurable, including listening to music or engaging in any kind of pleasurable activities. So I think that the answer is more of a maybe. I think that there's similarities. Does that mean sugar is addictive? I'm not sure, but I think the other question is, does it really matter? And what are the implications for that?
Right. Before we go to that, because that's an interesting point that you make, important point that you make, you talk about how addictions, that's a loaded term, right? It's a value-laden term, you say. And so I don't know, should we be talking about this in terms of addiction or no, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's particularly helpful to think about food in terms of addiction because it's very different than most of the other things that we conceptualize as addiction, you know, primarily drugs of abuse, alcohol, things like that. You know, food and sugar are things that occur naturally in our environment and actually things that our body needs, at least at some level, to function properly. When we think about addiction, we think about addiction treatment. And when I ask, is it helpful to think about sugar in terms of an addiction, really I'm thinking about the clinical implications of that. So when we say, you know, when people come in and they say, I'm addicted to sugar, and I have, you know, there's a number of people who identify in that way, it's kind of like, well, what do we do then? And for many people, the next logical step is to take an addiction treatment approach, something like a 12-step model or an abstinence-based approach, and try to completely eliminate sugar from our diet. Now, that becomes problematic because we know in eating disorder treatment, and I think there's a lot of overlap here, that type of approach actually worsens symptoms. So when we try to eliminate sugar from our diet, for most people, they feel even more out of control with sugar.
And that term addiction, as you say, it can be understood by different people in different ways, but that kind of phrase has entered the popular imagination, right? I have a sugar addiction, I have a food addiction. They may not actually be talking about a clinical definition of addiction.
Yes, and I think that, you know, sugar addiction is something that has become trendy. You know, it's something that we hear about a lot in the media, and we really want, you know, for many people who feel out of control with eating, we want to hold on to something. We want to look for something that seems like a simple answer to say, that's my problem. It's sugar. If I can eliminate sugar, then all of the issues will be solved. And unfortunately, it's rarely that simple. But I think that's what's very attractive in terms of wanting to grasp onto the idea of sugar addiction. And even in the research where they look at sugar addiction, it's a very small, you know, subset of the population that meets the criteria for sugar addiction. And I think there's a much larger number of people who self-identify as being addicted to sugar than the research would suggest actually meets the definition.
So, but if we stipulate, then move on to the next topic here. If we stipulate that sugar, excessive sugar is bad for you, right? I think. Then you go on to say, then the important question is, what do we do about that? And you know, one step that people advocate and maybe institute in our lives is abstinence. You want to say, well, that's pretty hard. Total abstinence from sugar, that's pretty hard in today's world.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree that, you know, abstinence, I think for most people, is not a realistic approach for this. And what we see is that for many people, when they try to eliminate sugar from their diet altogether, they feel, like I said, even more out of control around sugar. So when you say, you know, I can't have that chocolate brownie, all you can do is think about that chocolate brownie, and it becomes much more alluring and appealing and desirable than if you just said, oh, that's a chocolate brownie, I can have it if I want it. You know, and then we think about, do we even want that food? But I think as soon as we say it's off limits, whether or not we actually want it in that moment, it becomes, you know, like all that we can think about.
So I want to move, later in our discussion, I want to move to mindful eating. You talk about mindful eating. First of all, I do want to talk about another blog post for Psychology Today, and you talk about Mayor Bloomberg's, you know, proposed ban on sugar-sweetened beverages in portions larger than 16 ounces. That really hit the news. We'll talk about that a little bit elsewhere in this program. So you go on to treat some studies or review some studies, the link with diabetes, and that's a big issue. All right. So first of all, that there is, you seem to say that the studies say that there is a link. Increased prevalence of sugar equals increased prevalence of diabetes.
There is some research to suggest that. And I think that the really interesting point in that study is that it seems to be more about the increased sugar intake versus our weight. So often we link, you know, obesity with diabetes, and it seems to be that it's really much more about what we're eating, more so than what we weigh.
Yeah, that's an important point you make. I hadn't thought about that as much. You say what you eat is more important to your health than what you weigh. We have, I think, developed as a society a kind of obsession with weight, haven't we?
Very much so. And I think that it's really led us in the wrong direction, because the more preoccupied that we feel with weight and the worse that we feel about ourselves, the more disconnected from our bodies that we become, and we're very susceptible to all of the external cues to guide our eating that can guide us in directions that are not very attuned with what our body actually needs.
So you can be, I guess you can be unhealthy at a lower weight, you could be healthy at a higher weight.
Yes. Yes, very much so. And when we look at the research that actually accounts for things like nutrition, physical fitness, as well as stress and discrimination, we find that, you know, what we eat, how we move, and how we feel about ourselves seem to be much more important indicators of health than what we weigh.
So then, having said that, we do need to watch what we take in. You know, not too much sugar, right? Not too much of any food. Eating healthy. So you advocate mindful eating. Tell us about that.
So mindful eating is really just about being present and aware in the current moment. It's based on mindfulness meditation, and it allows us to listen to what our body's telling us. So we tend to think that we need all kinds of diet plans and listen to experts and, you know, look to someone else to tell us how to take care of ourselves. And actually, our body has very sophisticated, finely tuned mechanisms to guide our appetite and our eating. So mindful eating is just about trying to kind of step out of some of the conflicts that we have around food and our body, and to just listen in a more peaceful way to what our body is telling us, and trusting that it will guide us in the right direction when we can authentically listen in a different kind of way.
I wanted to step back and bring this in. You say this is a post from a recent post, April. Has obesity prevention led to a new epidemic? And one of the sentences here, are eating disorders the collateral damage in our war against obesity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that with all of the focus on weight and, you know, being thin at any cost, and this is the message that we often get, that if you're overweight or obese, losing weight will help you improve your health, kind of no matter what you do to lose that weight. And what we see is people engaging in a lot of really unhealthy behaviors to try to lose weight. And what I think is going on is that we're actually seeing really high rates of disordered eating, especially in people who meet BMI criteria for overweight or obesity. And this is being not only not diagnosed, but it's actually being encouraged by medical professionals.
So putting everything in context, being holistic, very important. I want to move to, you talk about something called the anti-diet plan. I don't think you're advocating, I guess I could use it as an excuse to just not do anything, right? I'm overweight. And if I could say, well, Dr. Connison says anti-diet plan, I don't have to do anything. I don't believe that's what you're saying. I'm guessing.
What the anti-diet plan is, it's not about giving up or kind of retreating from our health, but it's actually about acknowledging that what we've been doing isn't working. Dieting doesn't work. We try to restrict our intake. We end up, you know, sticking to a diet plan for a short amount of time. Most people feel more out of control with food than ever. We end up overeating. We experience guilt and shame and self-loathing, and we kind of get stuck in this cycle where then we go back on a diet plan and the same thing happens over and over and over again. So the anti-diet plan is a program that I developed to help people step outside of these dysfunctional patterns around food and actually start to listen to our body. So, you know, people always say, the anti-diet plan, does that mean that I can eat whatever I want whenever I want? And yeah, it does, but it's about listening to your body to really guide your eating so that you have a different understanding of what you want when you want it. Because when we lessen the restrictions around food, ironically, we are able to start to hear what our body's telling us, and food becomes, you know, that chocolate brownie is suddenly, it's just a chocolate brownie. It's not a measure of your self-worth. It's not something that you feel compelled to eat. It's not this whole emotional struggle that it is when it's restricted. And when we're really present with that experience, sometimes we, you know, have a few bites and notice that we feel satisfied. Sometimes we notice that we'd prefer to eat fruit at that moment than the chocolate brownie. Sometimes we notice that we're not hungry at all and we don't really care for it right now. So the anti-diet plan is really about just reconnecting with our body in a different way and trusting that our body will be able to guide us in a way that feels much more, much less conflicted than the struggle that we get caught in dieting. And also what happens with dieting, which I think is very problematic, is that we get convinced that it's our fault that the plans don't work, even though for most people we get stuck in these same patterns around feeling out of control with food. So the anti-diet plan is also about trying to reclaim the sense of our own self-worth.
Just a couple of minutes left here. You end one of these posts with something that really struck me. You talked about it a little bit earlier. Maybe you could expand on this. You say, this is the sentence, I wish you all peace in your relationship with food. And it you know, it's you saying it that way, you know, brought in bold relief. I think what a lot of us realize is we're not at peace with our relationship with food. How do we get there?
So I think peace comes really through self-compassion, through trying to move away from these, you know, kind of the mainstream way of thinking about dieting and our health. I think that we've been given some really problematic messages by the weight loss industry, which is that, you know, we can change our body if we just have enough willpower, motivation, and if we can't lose weight, that's our fault. And that it means that we're lazy, we're unmotivated, we're weak-willed. It becomes a moral failing if we don't have the body that looks the way that we're told it's supposed to be. And health is much more complex than that. Like I said, it's, you know, much more important what we're eating and how we're active and our stress and our mental well-being. All of those things affect our health in ways far greater than our weight. And I think that when we can kind of let go of this obsession, really, I think it's a cultural obsession with weight and thinness, and pair, you know, accept our bodies as they are now. Acceptance, I like to make the point, acceptance doesn't mean that things aren't going to change. It just means that you're opening your eyes to the reality and accepting that this, in this moment, this is the body that you're in. And from there, can we learn how to, with kindness and with compassion, truly care for our body and do things that make our body feel good, so be active in ways that feel good, that are fun, that are pleasurable, and eat in ways that give us energy and foods that we enjoy, and eating till we feel comfortably satisfied but not so full that we feel sick, because those, you know, that's not really what our body is typically craving. So I think that through self-compassion and through mindfulness and being present and trusting ourselves and stepping away from dieting, we are able to work towards developing a more peaceful relationship with food. And really, you know, I think it gives us freedom. We're, you know, many of us feel very much enslaved to dieting and preoccupied with thoughts of foods, and we're not living our lives the way that we want to be.
We have been talking with Alexis Connison. She is a clinical psychologist in practice in New York City and a researcher at the New York Obesity Nutrition Research Center at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital. You can find her at Psychology Today and many other media outlets. And the website is drconnison.com. Alexis Connison, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.